After breakfast the next morning, Kitty invited Matt to take a ride with her. The barn where Spirit had been boarded for the night was unlike any barn Matt had ever seen. It was very big, with extremely generous-sized stalls. There was fresh water and feed at each stall, and the barn was kept so clean and fresh-smelling that it was more like a hotel than a barn. He picked up his saddle from its stand and stepped into Spirit's stall.
I'll bet you've never seen any place like this before, Spirit. Now, don't go getting used to living like this. Trust me, Spirit, you won't be seeing another barn like this one.
With Spirit saddled, Matt led him outside. He had been there only a few minutes when Kitty rode out.
What do you think of my horse?
Kitty took in her horse with a wave of her hand.
I would say you are particularly well mounted.
Well, you'd say that no matter what, just because you're nice.
No, I mean it. He's just what you look for in a good-bodied horse. He has long, sloping shoulders, a short, strong back, long underline, and a long, rather level croup.
My, you do know horses. Where did you learn?
I learned from a man named Smoke Jensen.
We never knew each other's last name in the orphanage. Is Smoke Jensen family?
You might say that. You remember that I ran away from the orphanage?
Oh, yes, of course I remember. Captain Mumford said you died in the mountains, but none of us believed that.
I nearly did die, but someone found me, then took me in as if I were his own. And the funny thing is, he wasn't really that much older than I was at the time. He was a father, big brother, friend, whatever you want to call him. And he taught me everything I know.
So you took his name?
Yes.
Well, I think that's wonderful. Did he teach you how to ride?
Yep.
Good. Let's see how well he taught you. Now catch me if you can.
Suddenly, Kitty's horse exploded forward as if it had been shot from a cannon. Matt did not expect it. So by the time he realized he was being challenged, she was some distance ahead of him. Instead of heading for the road, Kitty galloped across the lawn, the hooves of her animal throwing up divots of grass. Matt had no choice but to dash after her. Kitty was heading directly for the stone wall that surrounded the estate. The wall rose high, not insurmountable, but high. Had it been an ordinary fence or a row of shrubbery, it would not have presented much of a challenge. But this wall was made of stone, and it was at least 3 feet wide. If the horse missed the jump, it could be fatal for the horse, and possibly for the rider as well. Kitty and her horse took the jump as if the animal had wings.
Come on, Spirit. Don't embarrass me.
Matt squeezed his knees against Spirit.
Damn, I didn't mean that, boy. Embarrassment is the least of my worries. Just don't kill yourself.
Spirit made the jump as well, and Matt saw that Kitty had stopped just on the other side to look back toward the wall. Then she urged her horse on, and it was all Matt could do to keep up with her. Kitty maintained the gallop for about a mile or so before she finally pulled up to a trot, followed by a cooling walk. Then, ending the ride at a grass-covered point that overlooked the Bruneau River. From this overlook, the river was about 100 feet below. It was obvious that Kitty had visited this spot many times because there was a bench that overlooked not only the river, but also the Owyhee Mountains. Sitting on it, she invited Matt to join her. Kitty was quite an attractive woman. Bareheaded, her blonde hair glistened in the sun. Her eyes were shining, and her full-breasted figure was displayed to advantage in her riding habit.
I'm impressed you made the jump. You're the first visitor I've had who's been able to make it. Most of them go around when they see the rock wall.
I confess that I thought about going around myself.
I shouldn't do that. Challenge my visitors to make that jump, I mean. I'd hate to think that my vanity might cost a horse its life.
It wouldn't be your vanity. It would be the vanity of the rider who took the jump unless they knew they could make it.
I suppose that's right.
Kitty looked at Spirit.
That's a fine horse you're riding as well. You call him Spirit?
Actually, he's Spirit the Second. My first horse was also named Spirit, but he was killed. He was such a special horse to me that I like to think that he, or his spirit at least, is living on. Somehow I think this horse understands that he's carrying on the name. I know that sounds silly.
No, it doesn't sound silly at all. Since I've become involved with horses, I've learned a lot about them. Horses understand us, not only our words, but our very thoughts. If you name this horse to honor your first, and this one knows exactly what you've done. And believe me, he carries the name proudly. I think that is a very nice thing to do.
Oh, I believe you, all right. It's like the jump he just made. I don't think once he saw the challenge, there's any way I could have held him back.
Then the two of you seem well matched. You too are obviously one who's up to a challenge. Otherwise, you wouldn't have responded to my letter.
Well, once I read the letter and knew who you were, there was no way I wouldn't come.
I wasn't sure you'd even remember me.
How could I forget you, Catherine? You were the prettiest girl there.
Oh, I think you may be indulging in a bit of flattery there. Especially since everyone knew how taken you were with Tamara.
Well, now, Tamara was an older woman. You know how boys are often intrigued by older women. As I look back on it now, it's hard to think of a 14-year-old as an older woman. But at the time, it's exactly what she was.
Tamara was the oldest of all the girls then. She was sort of the mother hen to the rest of us. Or at least she was our big sister. I really missed her when she left the home.
What happened to you after you left the home?
The smile left Kitty's lips.
Don't you know?
No.
Matt, I went the same path as Tamara and every other girl who left the home. Like all the others, I was sold into prostitution. Captain Mumford, you remember the head of the orphanage, and the people he sold us to, charged all the girls for room and board, then he arranged for Madame Crockett to loan us enough money to pay off the fee we owed to Mumford.
Madame Crockett?
Emily Crockett. She owned what she called a boarding house for women there in Soda Creek. The boarding house was a whorehouse, and we were bound to Madame Crockett until the loan was paid off. And of course, since we had to live off what we were getting, it took quite a while to pay off the debt. Some of the girls never got it paid off.
You did?
Yes, I did eventually. But it took 4 years. By that time, I knew no other profession, so I went into business for myself. That's what I was doing when Tommy came along. After his first wife died, Tommy became one of my regular customers. I don't know how or why, but for some reason, Tommy fell in love with me.
It's not that difficult to understand. You're a beautiful woman, Catherine, and I don't mean just your physical beauty.
Matt, you're being nice to me, for old time's sake.
No, really. You are a very beautiful woman.
I wouldn't have been if Tommy hadn't come along when he did. By now, I'd have been worn and haggard looking, or I'd be dead. So many of the girls in Mumford's home are dead now.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring up unpleasant memories.
I don't know if I'd call it unpleasant memories as much as I'd call it a simple fact of life. And for me, at least, it didn't turn out all that unpleasant. I wasn't in love with Tommy, not in the way a young girl dreams of falling in love. He was very good to me, and I did love him in my own way. But then, I'm not sure that someone like me, someone who's been on the line, can ever actually be in love with someone.
Now, don't sell yourself short, Catherine. You have a lot to offer. Your husband was a very lucky man.
Marcus certainly didn't think so.
Yes, Mr. Gilmore told me a little about Marcus Kincaid. I gather he was not all that pleased with the fact that you married the man who had been married to his mother.
I think that's what you'd call an understatement. I'm sure he believes that somehow I tricked Tommy into marriage in order to get out of the life and have all this. I must confess he's half right. I was anxious to get out of the life, and Tommy seemed like a good way of doing it. I knew Tommy. I knew that he was a very nice man, and I thought it would do no harm. But I swear to you, Matt, I didn't really know who he was, and I knew nothing about all this until after we were married.
With a sweep of her arm, she took in all the land they could see.
He told me he didn't want me to know about it beforehand because he wanted to be sure I was marrying him for him and not for his fortune. Bless his heart. He didn't know that I would have married him if he'd been a stable hand just to get out of that situation. Now I find myself in another situation, fighting off rustlers to hang on to this ranch.
In your letter, you said the rustlers were taking their toll of your stock.
Yes. But what's worse is that they've killed two of my riders, I'd gladly give up every horse I own if I could change that.
Kitty's eyes welled with tears, and when she began wiping them with the back of her hand, Matt gave her his handkerchief.
Thank you. One of the riders was a boy named Hank. He just turned 16 years old. Matt, he was raised in an orphanage, just as you and I. It kills me to think of that.
Think of it this way, Catherine. At least he was out on his own when he was killed. That means he died free and proud. And you and I can understand that more than most.
Yes, I can.
I hear that one of your men was a witness to the rustling.
Yes, Prue was out there that night, and he saw it.
Prue?
His real name is Jason Pruitt, but everyone calls him Prue.
I'd like to talk to him.
All right. He's back in the bunkhouse now, mending from the gunshot wound in the shoulder he got that night. He says he's absolutely certain that the man he saw was Polk Terrell. But Marshall Sparks says that seeing him from a distance in the dark won't hold up in court, especially since Terrell has witnesses who will say he was somewhere else that night. Maybe you can find some way of proving that he's the one who's been stealing my horses.
I'll do what I can, as long as you remember that I'm not a detective.
Oh, I'm already grateful to you, just for coming. And at the risk of your own life. Mr. Gilmore said two men tried to kill you back in American Falls.
Yes.
And again on your drive here from Medbury.
That's right.
I would say that they tried to kill you in order to prevent you from coming here to help me, but I don't know how that's possible.
What do you mean?
I mean nobody but Mr. Gilmore knew I'd sent for you. And even then, he did it by ruse.
Maybe it had nothing to do with my coming to work for you. I've made a lot of enemies in my life. The fact that some people tried to kill me after I received the letter from you could just be a coincidence.
But you don't believe that, do you? I mean, Mr. Gilmore knew the two men, and he said they were associates of Polk Terrell.
Yes, well, I didn't want you to feel responsible for it, but the truth is, I think you're right. I believe they were trying to keep me from getting to you to help.
You say you don't want me to feel responsible, but I do. I don't know what I was thinking when I sent for you. I guess I was just being very selfish. I never even gave a second thought to the fact that it would put you at such risk.
I've taken risks before, Catherine.
You don't have to worry about being a detective. I have something else in mind for you, if you'll do it.
I'll do it.
You don't even know what I'm asking.
Doesn't matter. If you want me to do it, and I'm physically capable of doing it, I'll do it. What do you have in mind?
Well, in a few weeks, I'll be transporting, by train, 500 horses to the U.S. Army Procurement Office in Chicago. I want you to accompany me on that train to see that the horses get through. If you'll do that, I'll pay you $10 per horse.
$10 per horse? Catherine, that's $5,000.
I know it's $5,000. I may be a woman, Matt, but I can do figures.
No, I didn't mean...
Oh, I was just teasing you. But seriously, Matt, it's well worth it to me to see them safely to their destination. I took out a $25,000 loan from the bank in order to start the horse farm. I have a contract with the Army that'll pay me $100 a head, which is enough to get me out of debt, but the money is payable only on delivery in Chicago. So you can see why I must get this shipment through.
All right. I'll shepherd your horses for you.
Thank you. I knew I could count on you.
She stood up.
Well, shall we be getting back then?
I don't know. You aren't going to jump that stone wall again, are you?
No. We'll go back another way. I'm sure you'd like to see some of the ranch.
As a matter of fact, I would.
Coventry on the Snake was mostly rolling upland grassy country. As they rode back in the distance, Matt could see mountains, dark blue at their base, and rising to majestic heights where little spindrift-like tendrils of snow trailed away from the brightly gleaming snow-covered peaks, showing white against the bright blue sky. The prairie below the mountain spread ablaze with a colorful profusion of wildflowers, yellow yarrow, red Indian paintbrush, light blue mountain phlox, and purple trillium. Just ahead of them, a jackrabbit ran along with them for a short distance until it grew tired, then it stopped and watched as the two riders passed by.
Fences divided the range into several different pastures, each pasture area containing a specific breed of horse.
If I didn't keep them separated, it'd be no time at all until I had such a mixture of breeds the horses would be practically worthless. As you can see, I have nothing but purebreds.
Well, Kitty, this is an impressive spread. But if I'm going to help you protect it, I better start checking around to see what I can learn about this neck of the woods you're in. Can I find a saloon in town? I usually pick up a lot of information just listening to the conversations.
You'll find two in town, but you'll get the best information if you go to the Sand Spur.
When Matt woke up, he was lying in a strange bed. Matt looked around at the room. Embossed metal tiles covered the ceiling, while 12-inch crown molding separated the ceiling from the wall. The wall itself was covered with white wallpaper, embossed with a pattern of flowers. The furniture, like the bed, was massive and elegant. This was not his room, and he had no idea how he got here. The last thing Matt could remember was mounting Spirit and riding away from the saloon, intending to return to Coventry on the Snake. He tried to sit up, but with the pain from the effort, he had to stay still for a moment until the pain went away. After a moment, he tried again. This time he was successful. Then realized for the first time that he was naked.
Oh, no.
At that very moment, the door opened and Matt looked around quickly but unsuccessfully for his pistol.
What are you doing sitting up? You shouldn't be getting up yet.
Frederica, carrying a tray, came into the room behind Kitty.
Lay back down. We've brought your lunch.
This isn't my room, but I must be at your house.
Yes, this is my room. And of course you're at my house. Where'd you think you were?
Matt looked around the room.
To tell the truth, I wasn't sure I wasn't in heaven. When I heard someone coming through the door, I thought maybe it was St. Peter coming to tell me that there'd been a mistake and I was going to have to be on the next train out of here.
I admit this is much nicer than Captain Mumford's home for wayward boys and girls, but I wouldn't exactly call it heaven. Now you lie back down, like I said.
How am I going to eat my lunch if I lie back down?
I'm going to feed you. Frederica, if you would please put his lunch there on the small table.
Si, senora.
Frederica set the tray of dishes on the table. Matt saw a bowl of soup, a large chunk of freshly baked bread, and a coffee pot.
Gracias.
De nada, señor.
Thank you, Frederica. I can handle it from here.
Frederica let herself out of the room and shut the door behind her.
How did I get here?
You don't remember?
Last thing I remember is starting to ride away from the saloon.
Kitty dipped the spoon into the soup, then held it out for Matt. He hesitated.
It isn't too hot. I let it cool a bit before we brought it up to you.
Oh, that's good.
Thank you. It's a duck soup that I made myself. I even made the noodles.
That's very good.
He picked up the piece of bread and tore off a piece, then stuck it in his mouth.
Mmm. Good bread, too.
So the last thing you remember is riding away from the saloon?
Yeah. I don't remember riding out here at all.
Not surprising, since you didn't.
What do you mean?
I mean, you didn't get very far. You got only as far as the school before you fell off your horse.
I fell off my horse? No, I don't think so. That's not possible.
Now, don't get your feelings all bruised. Maybe I worded that poorly. What I should have said is that you passed out from loss of blood, then you fell off your horse.
All right, that explains that part of it. But if I didn't ride out here, how did I get here?
Millie brought you here.
Millie?
She works in the saloon. It seems you made quite an impression on her. Should I be jealous?
Jealous?
I'm only teasing. Evidently, you were pretty badly hurt when you left the saloon, and Millie was worried about you. So she stepped outside to see how you were doing. And you weren't doing very well. You were weaving back and forth in the saddle as you rode away. Then, when she saw you fall from your horse, she ran down to you. She said that at first, she was afraid you were dead. But when she saw you move, she went to get Mr. Gilmore. Mr. Gilmore rented a buckboard for her and helped her get you into it. She drove it out here by herself.
Gilmore didn't come with her?
Are you serious? A saloon girl comes to his house in the middle of the night and you think his wife's going to let him go with her?
Well, I owe her my thanks. Not just for bringing me here, but for warning me I was in danger. Because of that, when I stepped out of the saloon last night, I was on my guard. Of course, I have to admit, I didn't expect a knife attack.
It wasn't last night.
What?
It was two nights ago. You were out all day yesterday and all night last night.
You're kidding.
You've slept, or more rightly, been unconscious, for 2 days and two nights.
No wonder I'm so hungry.
Now I don't know if you actually like my soup, or if you just like it because you're hungry.
Couldn't it be both?
I suppose it could.
Catherine, who undressed me?
Millie and I both did. And we put on your bandage. You embarrassed?
No, I reckon not. It's not like I've never been seen by a woman before. Where is Millie?
She had to go back into town yesterday. She said next time you come into town, be sure to drop into the Sand Spur and say hello.
I'll do that.
Matt looked around the room.
I'm sorry I put you out of your room.
You didn't.
What do you mean?
I spent both nights right here, with you.
Oh?
Don't worry, Matt. I haven't been compromised. As if that were possible with you being unconscious and all. But you've been drifting in and out of it so much that I thought you needed someone to keep watch over you. Although you're welcome to share my room and my bed for as long as you want, you could probably go back to your own room now if you feel up to it.
I appreciate the doctoring, and I appreciate you watching over me, but it would probably be better if I went back to my own room.
Don't get me wrong, Matt. It was delightful to feel you in bed beside me. But the truth is, right now, you're all I have to protect my investment. So I have to watch over you.
Matt felt up to getting out of bed later that afternoon, and Kitty said he could move to his room, but she insisted that he stay in bed at least one more day. To keep peace, Matt agreed to do so, and he did not get up, dress, and come downstairs until noon on the following day. He had eaten nothing but soup for the last 2 days, so when he came downstairs, even though he was in the parlor, he smelled something cooking. The aroma, which was very enticing, promised a meal that was a little more substantial than soup, so his mood improved considerably.
Smells good down here.
I had Frederica tell Maria to put a roast beef on this morning. I thought you might be ready for some solid food.
I'm more than ready. Truth is, I believe I could eat it whether it was cooked or not.
Wait here, I'll go see who it is.
As Kitty left, Matt walked over to have a seat in the rocking chair. A moment later, Kitty came back into the parlor with Marcus Kincaid trailing behind her. Matt stood up.
No, don't get up on my account. I heard about your trouble the other night. I wouldn't want to be the cause of you tearing something open.
I'm fine.
I must say, sir, you are the talk of the town. I mean, here, two knife-wielding ruffians tried to rob you, and you not only survived, you managed to kill Garcia.
Garcia?
Carlos Garcia. He works down at the... That is, he did work down at the depot in the feeder lot. The other one who attacked you had to be Lopez. They were a couple of Mexicans who worked together and roomed together down at Mama Sanchez's boarding house. Anyway, the next day, Marshal Sparks went down to the feeder lot to talk to Lopez, but Lopez was gone, and his boss said he hadn't been seen since it happened.
They weren't trying to rob me.
Of course they were. What other reason would they have for attacking you like that?
They were trying to kill me. They came out of the dark with their knives, and they attacked me without a word. If they'd been trying to rob me, they would have asked me for money.
Why would they be trying to kill you? Do you know them?
Because someone paid them.
What makes you think that?
Why was I attacked in American Falls? Why were Gilmore and I attacked on the way out here that first day? When you add that together, it can only mean that someone wants me dead.
As I understood it from the report Gilmore gave, you weren't actually attacked while you were on the way out here. Gilmore said that you saw someone on the lip of the canyon wall, then you stopped, then you went up to confront them. That's when you killed Sam Logan.
Who shot at me first?
There's only your word for that, isn't there?
Kincaid, if you got something stuck in your craw, spit it out.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not disputing your claim. I'm just repeating what Mr. Gilmore said in the report he filed. And it does point out how difficult the marshal's job is in enforcing the law when there are no eyewitnesses.
There were two eyewitnesses.
That's right, Mole and Cooter. Perhaps I should have said eyewitnesses who would be willing to give testimony.
Have they told the marshal a different story?
They told the marshal that it all happened so fast they didn't know what happened.
Don't you think that if they could convince the marshal that I was at fault, they would do so?
I suppose. I do wonder, though, why someone might be trying to kill you. Do you have any idea who that someone might be?
Yeah, I got a very good idea who wants me dead. It's Polk Terrell.
Ah, you've been listening to Pruitt, haven't you? Pruitt thinks he saw Polk Terrell the night the rustlers stole Kitty's horses. But there are eyewitnesses in the mud hole who will claim they were playing cards with Polk the night the robbery happened.
That's funny. According to what I hear about Terrell, he never plays cards with anyone but himself. Who were the three who were playing cards with him on the night Prue was shot and his two friends were killed?
Sam Logan, Al Madison, and Ken Jernigan. What's so funny?
All three of those men tried to kill me.
And all three of them are dead, which means their testimony can no longer be challenged. So as you can see, your assertion that Polk Terrell is trying to kill you would never be sustained.
Are you actually saying that I can't prove in court that Terrell is trying to kill me?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. You can bring charges if you want to, but it will go nowhere. You have no collaborative testimony. What is it? What do you find so funny?
I don't need any collaborative testimony. I don't have to prove it in court.
Why not?
Because I only have to prove to me. In this case, I'm the court. I'm the judge. I'm the jury. And when the time comes, I'll be the executioner.
Oh, my. If you don't mind, Mr. Jansen, I would like to give you a word of advice.
By all means.
I would be careful about making threats toward Polk if I were you. He doesn't strike me as the kind of man who would take such threats easily.
I'm not making threats, Kincaid. I'm simply stating fact.
I see. Oh, what is that coming from the kitchen? It smells divine.
We're preparing a pot roast for lunch. You're welcome to stay.
Why, thank you, Kitty. I do believe I will accept your kind invitation.
Because the roast beef was too large for two people, or even three, considering the unexpected arrival of Marcus Kincaid, Kitty invited Tyrone Canfield to dine with them.
Oh, Matt, I've got those numbers for you. I meant to give them to you as soon as I came in, but this meal is so good that it plumb slipped my mind.
What numbers are you talking about, Tyrone?
Tyrone looked over at Marcus, but didn't answer. Instead, he glanced back toward Kitty.
Oh, I'm sorry. I seem to have stepped into something that isn't any of my business.
I don't mean to be rude, but I reckon that's about it. I figure if Mrs. Wellington wants you to know, she'll tell you.
I don't mind. He's talking about horses, Marcus. The horses will be shipping to Chicago next week.
That's the contract you were telling me about earlier, the Army contract?
Yes. Matt will go into town tomorrow to arrange for railroad cars. 20 horses per car.
But you can get a lot more than that in a car. Why, when I ship cattle, I can get 50 to a car.
I'm not shipping cattle. I'm shipping purebred horses. And if you put any more than 20 in a single car, the chances are likely that some might be hurt. In fact, they might be hurt so badly that you'd have to put them down.
Even so, you should be able to at least double the number per car. I'm just looking out for you, Kitty. The cars are going to cost you at least $100 each.
I figure it's going to take a minimum of 25 cars. That would be with 20 head per car. Now, suppose I doubled the number of horses in each car, and suppose a minimum of 2 horses per car are hurt. In fact, I would say that that number's too low. I could wind up with as many as 3 or 4, or even 5 horses hurt per car. I could be looking at $4,000 in losses. On the other hand, if I limit it to just 20 horses per car, it'll cost me no more than $2,500 in railroad fees, which in the long run could be much cheaper. Also, we'll be more than likely to transfer every horse without injury. And besides the money consideration, there's something to be said for the welfare of the horses.
I'll drink to that.
Kincaid lifted his wine glass in a toast.
To my beautiful stepmother and all her horses.
I'm not your stepmother.
Very well, then. To your horses.
The others lifted their glasses to the toast.
What time are you going in tomorrow?
I'm going to help Tyrone and Prue select the horses that'll be shipped, then put them in a separate field before I start into town. I'd say about mid-morning. Why do you ask?
I have some business in town tomorrow as well. Perhaps you would like to have lunch with me.
Maybe I will.
Good. I shall look forward to it.
Kincaid pushed the plate away and stood up.
Kitty, I really must be going back into town. I know it's poor manners to leave immediately after having eaten, but I really must get back. Thank you for lunch. It was delicious.
You're welcome any time, Marcus.
I don't like that man.
I feel sorry for him. He was so certain that he would inherit everything, and then I came along. I'm sure it was quite a blow to him when Tommy left Coventry to me.
Mrs. Wellington, I don't mean to be talking out of turn. I mean, being as this is sort of family and all, but I've known Marcus Kincaid a lot longer than you. I've known him since he was a sprout. Sir Thomas had a heart that was just too big, so he either couldn't see it or wouldn't see it. But the fact is, even as a boy, Marcus Kincaid wasn't no good. He wasn't no good then, and he ain't no good now.
Cooter climbed up onto a rock from which he could see for nearly 2 miles back across the desert. A small rise hid everything beyond that point.
See anything?
Nothing but sand and rock, Mole.
Mole, a short, hairy man with gray eyes and a pug nose, took the last swallow from a whiskey bottle, then tossed it against a nearby rock. The bottle broke into two pieces.
Oh, damn, I shouldn't have broke that. I wasn't thinking, I guess. I could have got myself a penny back in town for it.
Gee, a penny. A penny ain't no money. Not compared to what we're going to be getting for this job.
Yeah, well, if you remember, we tried to kill this feller once before and it didn't work out all that well.
That's because we didn't know who we was messing with then. Logan didn't tell us nothing about him, so we wasn't ready for him when he snuck up on us like he done.
No, I don't intend to let him sneak up on us this time. You might not have seen nothing yet, but he's close. I know it.
How do you know it?
Because I can feel it in my gut. That's how I know it. He's out there, and he's close.
Cooter climbed down from a rock and walked over to his horse. He slipped his rifle out of the saddle holster.
What are you fixing to do?
Well, if he really is coming and he's all that close like you say he is, I don't aim to let him get any closer than a rifle shot.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that's the best idea you had yet. We'll just shoot the son of a bitch down as soon as he comes into range.
The two men with rifles in hand climbed back up onto the largest rock that afforded them not only a good view of the approaching trail, but also some cover and concealment. They checked the loads in the rifles, eased the hammers back to half-cock, then hunkered down on the rock and waited.
Let him come up to no more than about 100 yards. That way, he'd more than likely be out of pistol range.
What if we miss? 100 yards is a pretty long shot.
It ain't all that long a shot. And with both of us shooting, one of us is bound to hit him.
You know, what if we don't? What if all we do is just let the son of a bitch know that we're here? Well, next thing you know, he'll be on us like a fly on a horse turd, just like he was back in the canyon. And there won't be nothing we can do about it.
The thing to do is not to miss.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm beginning to think we shouldn't have took this job.
You ever had $500 before?
Oh, hell, you know damn well I ain't never had that much before. I ain't never even seen that much money before.
And shut up your yapping and just do what has to be done. Anyhow, we got all the advantage. He's out in the open and we got good cover here. Well, with the rocks and all. Besides which, he don't have any idea we're even here at all.
Well, I guess you're right.
Damn right I'm right.
At that moment, a rider came into view over a distant rise.
Son of a bitch! It's him! I told you he was close!
Mole raised his rifle to his shoulder.
Hold it!
Cooter reached out to pull Mole's rifle back down.
Be patient. You shoot now and you won't do no more than spook him. Let him get close like I say it. Besides, you was the one saying you didn't think you could hit him at 100 yards.
All right.
They waited as the distant rider came closer, sometimes seeming not to be riding, but rather floating as he materialized and dematerialized in the heat waves rising from the desert floor. On he came. A mile. Half a mile. A quarter of a mile. 200 yards. Cooter raised his rifle and rested it carefully against the rock, taking a very careful aim.
Just a little closer. A little closer before we fire.
Mole shifted position to get a better aim. As he did so, he dislodged a loose stone, and the stone rolled down the rock right into the largest unbroken piece of the whiskey bottle. The stone pushed the glass out into the sun. As Matt approached the ridgeline ahead of him, a sudden flash of light caught his attention, and he stopped, looking toward the flash.
What the hell did he stop for?
Looking down, Cooter saw the sun flashing off the broken whiskey bottle.
You dumb bastard! When you pushed that whiskey bottle down like you done, it commenced to flashing in the sunlight. You just gave away our position!
Ow! I didn't do it on purpose! You got no call coming down to me like that.
Where is he, anyhow?
Cooter stuck his head cautiously over the rock and looked down where the target had been.
Where is he? I can't see him.
I don't know. I seen him get behind that rock, but I ain't seen him since.
There's a dry creek bed down there. I seen it when we come through.
Mole looked toward him.
A dry creek bed? Damn! He could be right on us before we even knew it!
I don't think so. It curves away a long time before it ever gets up here.
No sooner were the words out of Cooter's mouth than there was a puff of smoke from a clump of bushes not too far distant.
Ow!
Mole slapped his hand to his face.
I've been shot right in the jaw!
Cooter looked at him.
I'd like to know what the hell you think is so funny!
You are. You're funny. You ain't been hit. That ain't nothing but a little old scratch.
I don't like this. He's getting too damn close.
Mole fired a couple of shots toward the bush just below the puff of gun smoke.
Hey, Mole, look down there. Ain't that his horse coming back up the road?
Yeah. Ooh, this is great. Let's shoot the horse. We'll just leave the son of a bitch afoot.
Both men started shooting at the horse, but the animal was still a couple of hundred yards away and slightly downhill. As a result, it wasn't hit, though the bullet striking the ground nearby caused the horse to turn and run toward the shelter of a bluff a quarter of a mile away.
Damn it! We missed.
Another bullet hit the rock very close beside them.
Come on, Cooter, let's get the hell out of here.
He started running for his own horse.
Mole! Mole, come back here!
Seeing the two men start to run, Matt tracked them with his rifle, firing at the second man. Mole made it to his horse. He kicked his horse into motion and in just a few seconds was behind a rocky ledge out of the line of fire.
Don't leave me, you bastard! Don't you leave me!
Matt approached Cooter, holding his weapon pointed toward him. Cooter threw up his hands.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! I'm shot! You can see that I'm bad shot!
Matt picked up the rifle Cooter had been using, jacked the three remaining bullets out of it, then threw the rifle over the edge of the hill so that it landed more than 100 feet below.
Mister, that rifle cost me $60.
Give me your pistol, butt first.
You ain't gonna throw it away too, are you?
Matt stuck Cooter's pistol down into his waistband.
Your name is Cooter, I recall.
Yeah, it is. How do you know my name?
This is the second time you've tried to ambush me, Cooter. I remember you from before when you were with Logan. At the time, you said Logan paid you. But Logan is dead, so who's paying you now?
You gotta get me to the doctor. If this wound ain't treated, I could wind up losing my leg.
Yeah, I suppose you could.
Matt knelt beside Cooter. He tore the trouser leg away and saw the entry wound. The bullet was still in the leg and the wound was still bleeding.
Take off your belt.
What do you mean, take off my belt?
You want to bleed to death?
No.
Take off your belt. I'm going to use it to make a tourniquet.
Cooter took off his belt and Matt looped it around the leg above the entry wound, then cinched it down tight.
Ah! That hurts!
Does it?
Do you know what you're doing? I ain't never heard of nothing called a tourniquet.
It'll keep you alive and more than likely let you keep your leg.
I need a doctor.
This'll do for now.
What do you mean this'll do for now? You ain't no doctor.
Who paid you to ambush me?
Nobody. We just done it because you killed our friend a few days ago.
Mister, if Sam Logan was your friend, all I can say is you have a piss-poor choice of friends. Now I'm going to ask you again. Who paid you to ambush me?
Why the hell should I tell you that?
Because I'll shoot you if you don't.
You're bluffing.
When you get to hell, say hello to your friend Logan for me.
No, wait!
Matt eased the hammer down on his pistol.
Who paid you?
You gotta understand that if I tell you paid me, he'll kill me.
Cooter, have you ever heard the term first things first?
No.
Well, let me tell you what it means. It means that you need to take care of the problem you've got now before you start worrying about any problem you might have in the future. I'm right here, right now, Cooter, and if you don't tell me who paid you to ambush me, I'm gonna kill you, right here and right now. Understand?
No, I mean, yes. I mean, don't shoot. Don't shoot, I'll tell you.
I'm listening.
It was poke Terrell.
Now, that wasn't all that hard, was it?
Once again, he eased the hammer down on his pistol, and this time he put his pistol back in his holster. Then he walked over to Cooter's horse and started to mount.
Hey, wait a minute. What are you doing? You're taking my horse again, aren't you? This ain't like the last time when I had two good legs. I can't do no walking on this leg.
I'm gonna use your horse to ride down and get mine. You may recall that you and Mole tried to kill my horse. I'll be back.
Shortly after Matt rode away on Cooter's horse, Cooter saw a pistol lying under a mesquite bush. At first, he didn't know how it got there, but when he picked it up, he recognized it. It was the one Logan gave Mole on the day they tried to ambush Matt Jensen the first time. Mole must have dropped it when he ran.
Well, Mole, you yellow-livered coward, I thank you for leaving me a gun like this, even if you didn't know you was doing it. Now, I'm going to take care of Matt Jensen and go see Polk to collect my money. Then I'm going to take care of you for running out on me like you done. All I have to do now is wait.
He waited.
Damn! What if he don't come back? There ain't no way I can walk all the way back to town on this leg.
He waited a few more minutes, growing ever more certain Matt Jensen would not return.
Oh, maybe he is a-coming.
Raising himself up, he saw Matt Jensen coming back, riding his own horse and leading Cooter's horse.
I was beginning to think you'd forgot me.
I thought about it. Get mounted. We're going into Medbury.
Cooter mounted with some effort, his face grimaced with pain.
I know damn well it's not hurting you that much, so you can quit the show. I'm not believing any of it.
Well, that's because you ain't got no bullet in your leg.
Matt could have told Cooter that he had a knife slice on his side that was rib deep, but he said nothing. Matt was correct in his belief that Cooter was faking more pain than he was actually feeling. Cooter was playing for time, waiting for the right opportunity, and when he saw Matt turn away from him, he was positive that the opportunity had presented itself. Reaching around behind, he pulled Mole's pistol from his waistband, then he brought it around and aimed it at Matt's back.
I got you now, you son of a bitch!
Cooter should not have yelled. He did not count on Matt's phenomenal reaction time because even as Cooter was yelling and pulling the trigger, Matt was falling off his horse. The contact with the ground was hard and painful, doubly so because it slightly reopened the wound on Matt's side. Halfway down to the ground, Matt pulled his pistol, but by the time Matt actually hit the ground, he had brought his gun to bear and pulled the trigger. When Matt came riding into Medbury, he was leading Cooter's horse. Cooter lay draped belly down across his saddle. Matt's entry into town aroused immediate attention. People riding or driving in the street, as well as pedestrians, saw the body draped over a horse. Many of them interrupted their transit to their original destination in order to follow Matt. Other townspeople engaged in commerce inside the stores and buildings, both customers and merchants, who saw the macabre parade through the windows, came pouring out of the stores and buildings, including one man who ran out from the barber shop still draped in the barber's cape, with the barber brandishing his razor chasing after him. They joined the growing throngs of people now walking alongside Matt, keeping pace with the two horses as they moved down the street.
Ain't that Cooter's horse?
Yeah, it's Cooter's horse. That's Cooter lying across the saddle.
He looks dead.
Hell yeah, he's dead. You think he'd be lying belly down on his horse that way if he weren't dead?
That's Matt Jensen leading him. I reckon you've heard of Matt Jensen.
Yeah, but I didn't figure he'd ever come back into town after he killed the Mexican the other night.
The curiosity of the crowd grew even greater when Matt stopped in front of the sand spur. The crowd followed, but kept a reasonable distance because no one wanted to incur Matt Jensen's anger.
What do you reckon he stopped here for? How come he didn't go on down to the Undertaker? I mean, what else for would he be bringing in Cooter's body if he wasn't bringing him into the Undertaker?
Why don't you ask him?
No, sir, not me. I ain't gonna ask him nothing.
Tying first his own horse off and Cooter's horse, Matt slid Cooter's body off the saddle, draped it across his shoulders, stepped up onto the porch, and pushed his way through the bat wing doors.
Here now, what are you doing there? You can't be bringing no dead body into a saloon like that. There's folks drinking in here.
Matt looked at the woman, fixing her with such a steely glare that she blanched, then took a couple of steps backward.
Of course, I reckon that's your business.
Upon seeing Matt come into the saloon with a body draped over his shoulder, most of the patrons jumped up from the tables and moved back out of the way. One man, however, was conspicuous in that, unlike the other patrons of the saloon, he remained seated. He was playing a game of solitaire, and he gave the impression that he was so engrossed in his game, he didn't notice Matt. Matt had never seen Polk Terrell, but the man sitting at the table was short and stocky, bald-headed, and with no neck, which was exactly the way Polk had been described to him. Matt also saw Mole. It was obvious Mole had been talking to Polk because, though he moved away from the table, he stood in close proximity to it. Matt walked back to the table. Not until then did Polk look up.
I got a play for you, Polk.
What would that be?
Without ceremony, Matt dumped Cooter's body onto the table.
Dead man on the Black Queen.
Polk made no abrupt movement.
I was winning this game. Do you have any idea how hard it is to win at Old Saul?
This is number 5 for you.
Number 5? I don't know what you're talking about.
Al Madison, Ken Jernigan, Sam Logan, Carlos Garcia, and now Cooter. I don't know what his real name is.
Why are you telling me all this?
Because you're the son of a bitch who keeps sending them after me.
You got no call to be talking to Mr. Terrell that way.
Matt jerked his pistol from his holster, pointed it at Mole, and cocked it.
You were there with Cooter both times. You were on the canyon wall, and you were with Cooter this morning.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You don't?
I swear. I don't have the slightest idea.
Then you're gonna die dumb. I don't plan to give you any more chances to ambush me. So I'm gonna kill you right now.
No! No, no, no! I ain't even carrying a gun! You can see my holster's empty! I think Cooter stole it!
Did he now? Well, you can take that up with him when you see him in hell.
No! No! No!
Mole dropped down onto his knees.
Get out. Get all the way out of town. If I ever see you again, I'll kill you.
Yeah, I'm going.
Mole got back on his feet. He ran toward the door, pushing through those who had gathered just outside.
Mister, I don't know who you are, but you don't come in here and threaten me or my friends. I won't put up.
Matt brought his pistol around in a vicious backhand, hitting Polk in the side of the head. Polk wound up on his back on the floor.
Oh. Son of a bitch!
Polk pulled his pistol from his holster. Matt closed in on him one step. He sent a swift kick against it, knocking the pistol out of Polk's hand. Polk rolled over onto his hands and knees and stayed that way for a moment. Polk launched himself in a bull-like charge toward Matt. The sudden charge caught Matt off guard, and he dropped his pistol as Polk drove him across the room before slamming him into the bar. The ferocity of the attack momentarily stunned Matt, and he was unable to respond. Polk took advantage of Matt's immobility, then pulled back away from him just far enough to send a hammer-like blow into Matt's side. The blow knocked Matt back, and he fell onto one of the tables. Polk ran over to him and raised his foot with the intention of bringing it down hard on Matt's head. Matt grabbed Polk's leg and twisted it, causing Polk to go down. Matt rolled over to him, then knocked him out with a blow to the chin. Now, breathing hard and bleeding from the reopened wound in his side, Matt got up from the floor and stumbled over to the bar.
Whiskey.
Yes, sir. And this one's on the house, Mr. Jensen. I reckon you've earned it.
You dropped this.
Millie handed Matt his pistol.
Thanks. And thanks for the other night. Not only for the warning, but for taking care of me. Catherine told me what you did.
It wasn't anything that anybody else wouldn't have done.
But that's the point, Millie. Nobody else did it.
By now, everyone had crowded back onto the floor of the saloon. Many were repositioning tables and chairs. Polk was sitting up on the floor now, with his head hanging down. Nobody would dare approach him.
Oh, honey, you're bleeding real bad.
Millie put her fingers on Matt's shirt.
Come on up to my room and let me take care of that for you.
Mister, look out!
Matt turned toward Polk.
Matt shot, hit Polk in the middle of his chest.
Millie!
Matt dropped down beside Millie. She smiled at him.
Oh, Kitty told me what a good man you are. I said she didn't have to tell me that. I already knew.
Matt stood up and looked over at Polk. He walked over and stood over him, then pointed his gun at Polk's head and cocked it.
Mister, you'll just be wasting a good bullet on that worthless son of a bitch. He's already dead.
Matt rode back out to Coventry on the Snake that evening after a quick inquiry with the circuit judge cleared him of any wrongdoing. Heading back, he realized that not only had he not had lunch with Marcus Kincaid, he didn't even see him while he was in town. He also made no arrangements for the livestock cars, and that had actually been the primary purpose of his visit. His day had turned unexpectedly busy. He was sure that Kitty would understand. What he didn't realize was that it was about to get busier. He felt the bullet before he heard the sound. Actually, he didn't feel the bullet as much as he felt the effects of the bullet because his hat flew off his head. Matt jerked the reins of his horse hard to the right toward a large rock that would give him protection. Once he was behind the rock, he jumped from the saddle, then climbed up onto the rock to see who had taken the shot at him. When he saw Mole, he wasn't surprised. Mole took a second shot at him. Matt shot back. One shot was all it took. Though Logan, Mole, and Cooter rode pine boxes to their unmarked graves in Potter's Corner of the town cemetery, Kitty arranged for a proper funeral for Millie, including the finest casket available and a tasteful headstone. Matt swung his legs over the side of his bed as he woke on the morning of the funeral.
Yeah.
Senor Jensen, it is Frederica.
Just a minute.
Quickly, Matt pulled on his pants and put on a shirt. Then, with his shirt tucked into his trousers, he opened the door. Frederica was standing there, holding a cloth garment bag.
Por favor, Senora Wellington asks if you would please wear this for the funeral.
Thank you.
Closing the door, he took the bag over to his bed, unbuttoned it, and looked inside.
All right, Catherine. If you want me to wear this, I will.
Kitty turned as Matt walked into the parlor a short time later.
Oh, my. You look good in Tommy's suit. In fact, you look more than good. You look positively handsome.
Frederica had to let the jacket out some for me to wear.
Matt held out his arms and looked down at himself. He stood wearing a black suit, gray silk vest, and black string tie, clothing that once belonged to Sir Thomas Wellington.
Yes, in the shoulder, she told me. In fact, I think her exact words were that you were a very strong man.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you, Catherine, I don't feel all that strong right now. That fight with Polk took quite a bit out of me.
Are you sure you feel up to going? I mean, with your side and all?
My side is bothering me some, I admit. But I'd go to Millie's funeral if I had to hold my guts in with my own hands.
Oh, my. How descriptive of you. But hopefully, that's not going to happen.
Did you know Millie from somewhere before here?
Yes and no.
Matt looked confused.
I never met Millie before the night she brought you out here, but I knew her because I've known dozens of girls just like her. And as you know, I was just like her myself once. I know it might be hard for you to understand.
No, it isn't at all hard for me to understand.
Matt and Kitty looked to the door and saw Tyrone Canfield standing just outside the parlor in the hall. Like Matt, Tyrone wore a suit, though even as he stood there, he tugged at the collar, giving evidence of his discomfort in such apparel.
I have the team ready for the hearse. I chose a couple of black Percheron mares.
Good choice. Go ahead and take them on into town to Mr. Welch. Matt and I'll follow in the surrey.
Yes, ma'am. Prue hitched up the surrey and brought it around, but if you don't mind, he'd like to ride into town with me.
Of course I don't mind.
Thank you, ma'am. We'll see you in town.
Tyrone started toward the front door. Kitty watched Tyrone leave, then she turned back to Matt.
Are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Kitty saw Matt wince as he turned for the door.
Maybe I'd better drive.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
The Surrey stood parked in the curved driveway, sitting right in front of the great stone steps. It was a very attractive vehicle, polished black lacquer with yellow wheels, red leather seats, and a black leather top. The Surrey's handsome team of matching white Arabians looked eager to get underway. Matt reached the top step of the porch, then stopped.
What's wrong? Do you not feel up to going?
No, it isn't that. It's just that, well, I don't have my pistol with me. This will be the first time I've gone anywhere without my gun for almost longer than I can remember.
Pope Terrell is dead. His sorry carcass is lying under 6 feet of dirt in an unmarked grave in the back corner of the Medbury Cemetery. Why do you need your gun now?
No reason, I guess. It's just that I feel naked without it.
But you aren't. Honey, I've seen you naked.
Some in town thought it unnecessary to have a funeral for a whore. In fact, a few thought it almost sacrilegious to do so. But the Episcopal priest, Father Walt Pyron, believed everyone deserved a Christian burial, so when Kitty asked him if he would perform the service, he agreed without hesitation. Surprisingly, a large crowd stood outside the church waiting for the doors to open. Whether the people came out of a sense of piety and genuine compassion for the young fallen woman, or merely out of curiosity, Kitty didn't know, nor did she care. She was just pleased they came. Kitty, Matt, Tyrone, Charlie the bartender, Amos the piano player, Jenny and the other girls who worked at the Sandspur sat in the very front row. The other seats filled on a first-come, first-seated basis. Within moments after the church's red doors opened, the pews filled. Spillovers lined the walls on each side or stood at the rear, crowding even out into the narthex. More people stood outside, waiting for the service to end, so they could accompany the funeral cortege to the graveyard. Father Pyron came out of the study, closed its door, and mounted the pulpit.
I know that there are some, perhaps even present in this congregation, who would take issue with me conducting funeral rites for someone like Millicent McMurtry. Yes, the young woman whose life we are here to celebrate was a prostitute. But I am told by those who knew her best that prostitution was not a profession she chose because of any prurient nature or unholy desire for lucre. Instead, like many a young woman who has found herself thrust into the world with not one person to provide for her, Millie turned to the only means she believed was available to provide sustenance. That this was the only avenue open to her is the shortcoming of us all, for we, as a society, failed Millie, as we have failed all young women in similar circumstances. But know this, the fact that Millie was a soiled dove does not mean she is a lost soul. We are told in the book of Matthew that a harlot who is good at heart will be welcomed into the kingdom of God. And those who knew Millie knew that she was truly a woman with a heart of gold, a child of God. It is my belief that Millie is in heaven today.
A funeral procession that more resembled a parade, given all the wagons, carriages, buckboards, riders, and pedestrians following the hearse, took Millie's coffin to the gravesite.
Most merciful Father, who has been pleased to take unto thyself the soul of thy servant, Millicent McMurtry. Grant to us who are still in our pilgrimage, and who walk as yet by faith, that having served thee with constancy on earth, we may be joined hereafter with thy blessed saints in glory everlasting. Through Jesus Christ our Lord, amen.
At a nod from Father Pyron, the six pallbearers with ropes looped around Millie's coffin lowered it gently into the open grave. Then, withdrawing the rope, Pyron invited Kitty and the other girls who worked at the Sandspur to drop a handful of dirt onto the coffin. As the dirt fell upon the coffin, Pyron gave the final prayer.
For as much as it hath pleased Almighty God in His wise providence to take out of this world the soul of our deceased sister, we therefore commit her body to the ground. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, looking for the general resurrection in the last day and the life of the world to come through our Lord Jesus Christ. at whose second coming in glorious majesty to judge the world, the earth and the sea shall give up their dead, and the corruptible bodies of those who sleep in him shall be changed, and made like unto his own glorious body, according to the mighty working whereby he is able to subdue all things unto himself.
Railroad service did not run directly to Boise, so Marcus Kincaid left the train at Thurman City and took a stagecoach for the 10-mile ride up to the territorial capital. For all that it was the capital, it was not a very large town, and it was but a short walk from the stage depot to the headquarters building of the Idaho Auxiliary Peace Officers Posse. It wasn't hard to find the building. A sign hung from the overhanging porch in front of the building. Another sign shone painted on the window itself, identifying this as the headquarters of the Idaho Auxiliary Peace Officers Posse. Two men stood in front of the building, one tall and broad-shouldered, with a neatly cropped mustache, wore denim trousers, a light gray shirt, and a star-shaped badge on his left pocket. The other man wore a three-piece suit. The man in the suit was leaving, so Kincaid stopped short of going up to them and waited. After a few more minutes of conversation, the two men shook hands, then the man in the suit left, heading toward the Capitol building. The tall man with a mustache and star looked over at Kincaid.
Have you come to see me?
Are you Clay Sherman?
I am Colonel Sherman, yes.
Then yes, I have come to see you.
Who are you?
My name is Marcus Kincaid, Colonel Sherman. I'm from...
Oh, yeah, I know who you are, and I know where you're from.
Sherman pointed toward the man who had just left.
Do you know who that is?
No, I'm afraid not.
That is Nathaniel Patterson, the Assistant Deputy Attorney General for the Territory of Idaho. I'm in good standing with the territorial government. And why shouldn't I be? My posse provides services that the territory is simply unable to provide.
But you provide those services for private individuals as well, do you not?
I do.
I require just such a service.
Come in, Mr. Kincaid. We'll talk.